Support comes from Russell Reynolds Associates. Call them change makers. Call them rule breakers. We call them redefiners. Join hosts Nanaz Motashami and CEO Clark Murphy as they engage in purposeful conversations with leaders in and out of the business world who share their insights and perspectives on how they lead boldly. Fresh ideas and tangible takeaways. Redefine your own leadership trajectory, no matter where you are in your journey. Listen to Redefiners wherever you get your podcasts.
A diplomatic spat between China, the U.S., and Canada finally gets resolved, with Beijing sending a strong message, don't mess with us.
This is a lesson for Canada, for the U.S., and other Western countries. If you take unfair actions on Chinese citizens, Chinese government will retaliate.
Also today, German voters chart a new future.
After 16 years of Angela Merkel, I think there's a sense that we needed a fresh start.
But what does that fresh start look like? And we go behind Cambodia's COVID vaccine success story.
For a small, poor country, Cambodia's up there with some of the most successful countries on earth, including the most developed countries.
We'll hear how Cambodia's government found that path to success. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and a trip to the park for a Brazilian kite battle, all coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us on this Monday. Meng Wanzhou is back in China. She is the tech executive at the center of a diplomatic spat involving China, as well as Canada, the U.S., and Iran. Meng is the CFO of the Chinese company Huawei. She was detained back in 2018 in Canada. Washington wanted Canada to extradite her to U.S. soil to face charges related to evading sanctions on Iran. That extradition never happened, though, and last Friday, Meng Wanzhou was released. Later that same day, China freed two Canadians, Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor. They're now back in Canada after being detained for more than 1,000 days. For The View from China, we turn now to The World's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai. Rebecca, this is by all accounts big news in China. What has been going on since word got out on Friday that Meng Wanzhou was flying back to China and then she arrived?
Well, you have to understand, she's a household name here. So she's the daughter of the founder of Huawei. And so her return to China was huge news. Her arrival back was live streamed. And I've seen reports that more people worldwide watched her return online than the combined population of the U.S. and Canada. The live stream was very carefully orchestrated, and there was a red carpet lined up on the tarmac at the Shenzhen airport. There was a crowd of about 100 well-wishers from the government, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, her colleagues from Huawei, and they were all waving little Chinese flags. And she stepped off the plane wearing a red dress and waving to the crowd. And then two people in full PPE presented her with giant bouquets of red roses, and the crowd was chanting, "Welcome home." I mean, the political pageantry here, it was kind of over the top.
Yeah, a real celebration, if not a little surreal. Did Meng say anything for the cameras?
Yes, she did. She actually had a prepared speech. So she's saying, as an ordinary Chinese citizen who has suffered this plight and been stranded abroad for 3 years, there was never a moment where I did not feel the care and warmth of the Communist Party, the motherland, and the people. What happened next was Meng was singing along with the crowd as it broke into a rendition of Ode to the Motherland. This is a patriotic song that's, I guess, like the equivalent of America the Beautiful.
So, Rebecca, how is all this being explained in China's news media?
Well, you know, in the U.S., the Department of Justice says that Meng admitted to, quote, deceiving a global financial institution. And that was related to business dealings with Iran. But in the Chinese news media, this detail is left out. So her detention is described as a purely political move on the part of the U.S. And her return is seen as a diplomatic win for Beijing. So one headline here reads, a major victory won through struggle.
And what about the Chinese public's view of the story? Do you get a sense of that through social media?
Yeah, it was all over my WeChat and Weibo feeds. I mean, you have to understand that Huawei currently has a lot of support from most Chinese people. It's one of China's top tech companies, and people are proud of it. It's, I mean, almost a way to show their national pride. So the fact that Meng is back in China, that she was not extradited to the U.S., is a sign that the Chinese government looks out for its people.
So after the news of Meng Wanzhou's release, as many expected, the two Michaels were released by China, Michael Kovrig and Spavor. What about Chinese coverage of those two Canadians who were detained just 9 days after Meng Wanzhou was and are now free and back in Canada?
In China, the release of the two men wasn't reported immediately. On Sunday, though, reports started coming out that the men had been released. And these reports highlighted the fact that both men admitted to being guilty of espionage. I spoke with Wu Xinbo, who's the director of the Center of American Studies at Fudan University, about this. And he said the timing of their release wasn't exactly a coincidence.
China wants to show that I have the means and resources to retaliate. This is a lesson for Canada, for the U.S. and other Western countries to learn from it. In the future, if you take unfair actions on Chinese citizens, Chinese government will take actions to retaliate without any hesitation.
So the disconnect here is that outside of China, these Canadian men are seen as innocent. They are a businessman and a former diplomat who were living and working in China. And outside of China, there's no sense that they are guilty of spying. And that's got to worry many foreigners living here in China.
The World's China correspondent, Rebecca Canther in Shanghai. Thank you very much for the latest.
Thank you.
The return to China of Huawei CFO Meng Wanzhou revealed something about U.S.-China relations. Sometimes uncomfortable compromises are required. Michael Byers has been following the apparent prisoner swap. He knows the history of diplomacy between Washington and Beijing. I spoke with him earlier while he was on a busy lunch break at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, where part of the story began. When you look back at the turn of events on Friday, Michael, a seemingly sudden hearing for Meng in a Brooklyn federal court, then she flies back to China, and China releases the two Canadians, who then return to Canada, almost all according to plan. What goes through your mind?
I wasn't surprised by the deferred prosecution agreement that Ms. Meng concluded with the U.S. Department of Justice. I could see that coming because otherwise this case would remain in the Canadian courts for many years through multiple appeals. But I was very surprised that the Chinese released the two Canadians immediately.
So much of what happened diplomatically is shrouded in secrecy. Canada gets the Michaels, covert in favor, but what does the U.S. get out of what looks like a prisoner swap between China and Canada?
Well, you have to remember that Ms. Meng was detained under an extradition warrant issued during the Trump administration. And we have a new administration in Washington, obviously, that has a different set of priorities. And I would suggest that the number one priority in terms of foreign policy for Joe Biden is finding some renewed stability in the relationship with China.
I mean, doesn't the U.S. still see Huawei and Meng as violating the Iran sanctions protocol? Doesn't the U.S. lose some poker chips here?
It has lost one poker chip out of the hundreds that it can play, and it can still pursue the company. It can still pursue Huawei.
Remind us why Canada did not seem keen on extraditing Meng Wanzhou to the U.S.
Canada arrested Ms. Meng, put her through the extradition process in a British Columbia court, adhered very strictly to the terms of the treaty. And it was the United States that made the concession to China, not Canada. And that's a really important point for Canada, because Canada was put under extreme pressure from China, lots and lots of trade sanctions, the detention of the two Canadian citizens in China. China tried to break Canada's back on this one, and Canada actually stood up and refused to bend. And that's really important because, unlike the United States, Canada is not a superpower, and getting pushed around by China would be a very bad thing in terms of setting a precedent for future demands.
No doubt this is going to be an episode that will be carefully filed away and referred to as U.S. deals diplomatically with China going forward. What is the lesson, do you think?
China is different from the way the Soviet Union used to be. And remember, we had a similar difficult relationship with the Soviet Union for decades. China is deeply integrated with the global economy. It needs Western democracies as markets. And so it can't disengage. It can't risk sliding into a breakoff of relations and possibly armed conflict. Its economy is dependent on the West just as much as our economies are dependent on it. So there's lots of self-interest here. There's lots of reasons to work together. There are lots of reasons to avoid the small problems and focus on the big ones. Climate change, there are pandemics, there's the frictions in the South China Sea, Hong Kong, there's Taiwan, the desperate human rights situation in Western China. The list goes on and on. And Meng Wanzhou and the two Canadians were down in the 20 or 30th place on that list. This was not a priority, and the Biden administration made the problem go away.
Michael Byers teaches political science at the University of British Columbia, joining us on his busy lunch break to unpack the diplomacy lesson after an apparent prisoner swap between China and Canada. Michael, thank you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Some of my fondest memories of growing up in New York City are of flying kites with my dad in Central Park. In Brazil, kids and adults take kite flying to a whole new level, and it's only grown during the pandemic, which sparked even more interest in flying kites. Many Brazilians now consider it a sport. As Michael Fox reports, kite competition in Brazil is more like boxing.
It's late afternoon in a working-class neighborhood in the north of Rio de Janeiro. Cinderblock homes hang on the hillsides. Dozens of teenage boys dart across a huge barren field, dragging on seemingly endless lines of string. Far above them, their kites dance and jerk in the sky like tiny butterflies, or better yet, sharks, swimming back and forth before the setting sun. They're kite fighting. The goal is to cut your opponent's string before yours is cut. They use special powder on the strings to sharpen them like a knife. Last kite in the sky wins. As the kite falls, kids run to catch it. Kite flying is not just a family activity in Brazil, it's a battle. And it's a passion for boys, adolescents, and increasingly adults across the country. Today, it's considered one of Brazil's most popular sports. That is, after futebol or soccer. Just to give you an idea, this one YouTube channel, Pipa Combate, or Kite Fight, has almost 2 million followers. The host travels to communities and kite competitions around the country. In this video posted a few years ago, he's battling opponents in Brazil's first kite fighting world championship. One of the kites goes down, and the cameraman cheers. Kids and adults in Brazil have taken to the skies. The pandemic forced people to socially isolate. Schools were out and unemployment rose. Rafael Felipe Teixeira grew up in the 1990s flying and making kites in Vila Medeiros, a poor neighborhood on the north side of Sao Paulo. The pandemic awakened this interest I still had, he says. Since I was at home and had free time, I said, I'm going to make a kite. I had no idea how big it would get, he says. Today, he makes high-end, personalized kites, which he sells and promotes over his Instagram and YouTube channels. Some of his kites, he says, can even run up to 100 reais or $20. That's a lot. Kites in Brazil, even now, generally run between 7 cents and 2 US dollars. Remember, they're made to be disposable, lost in competition. The demand for high-end kites like Teixeira's is a sign of the changing times. Manuel Roberto Kuscher has made and sold kites out of a store near his home for 35 years. He sent me a picture of a group of middle-aged men holding tiny trophies won at a Sao Paulo kite flying competition over the weekend. Look at the age of the kids who fly kites today, he joked in a voice message he sent. But there's a problem. In order to cut each other's strings, kite fighters often use wax lines with either crushed glass or more expensive, industrially produced strings made with quartz and aluminum oxide powder. These are effective, but highly dangerous. Dozens are wounded or even killed each year when the kites are cut and the lines fall across roadsides. The line cut into my helmet, one motorcyclist told a TV reporter in 2018. He said he was nearly blinded by the deep cut near his eyes. These types of strings are now banned in Brazil, and police have taken some measures to crack down on their sale. But veteran kite maker Manuel Roberto Kuscher says they're still out there. You know how laws are in Brazil. In the middle of public squares, guys are there selling it, he says. Some elected officials are now calling for designated kite flying areas. In the meantime, there is now this contradiction at the heart of kite flying in Brazil. As the passion grows, the tools may be making it more dangerous. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Mile-long lines formed outside of gas stations across the United Kingdom over the weekend. People got spooked as rumors flew about an imminent fuel shortage. Officials tried to reassure the public that it was not the case. But sure enough, thousands of gas pumps ran dry. For more, here's Andrew Connolly from London.
A fight breaks out at a petrol station in North London on Sunday as rumours of a nationwide fuel shortage sets off panic buying. Energy giant BP says that a third of its petrol stations have run out of gas. One industry group says that 50 to 90% of its members have reported dry pumps, with more expected to follow. Drivers queuing for fuel in West London this morning expressed their frustration to Sky News.
I've literally been waiting for petrol for 3 days. Like, all weekend I've had no petrol, literally on zero, but we've been driving around trying to get into school and trying to get petrol at the same time.
I was meant to be at work at 8 o'clock, but the time is right now. It's terrible. I tried to come here last night, same thing. Went to 3 different petrol stations, all closed.
But here's the thing. The government says there is no fuel shortage, as Environment Secretary George Eustace tried to explain earlier today.
There is no shortage of petrol, plenty of petrol in both our refineries and in storage. The only reason we don't have petrol on forecourts is that people are buying petrol and they don't need it.
So, there's plenty of fuel in the country, but nobody to transport it to petrol stations. The reason? A perfect storm of COVID-19 and Brexit. Lockdowns over the last 2 years have caused delays in the training and testing of new drivers. On top of that, industry experts say that up to 20,000 drivers, mostly from European Union countries, have returned home since Brexit. At the end of 2020, the UK officially left the EU, creating trade barriers and tighter immigration rules overnight. The British government insists that the current fuel problems are not due to Brexit, but some European leaders disagree. Here's Olaf Scholz, leader of Germany's Social Democrats and the favourite to succeed Angela Merkel as Chancellor following Sunday's election.
The free movement of labour is part of the European Union, and we worked very hard to convince the British not to leave the Union. Now they decided different, and I hope that they will manage the problems coming from that.
Ministers have announced that the UK will issue up to 5,000 emergency visas to European truck drivers to help ease the crisis. Although the scheme is already being criticised for its temporary nature, those visas are set to expire on Christmas Eve. Here's Tomasz Oryński, a Polish truck driver living in Scotland, speaking to the BBC this morning.
To think that the migrants are like tap with water, which you can open and close where you need it, it's just insolence.
Meanwhile, the sense of crisis is building. Drivers worry that more panic buying could lead to a genuine shortage and become a self-fulfilling prophecy. But this farce could soon descend into tragedy amid rising concerns that food and medicine supplies will not be delivered. Trade unions are calling for emergency workers, teachers and people who care for the elderly to be prioritised at the pump. The government is even discussing the prospect of calling in the army to drive oil tankers. By Monday afternoon, energy industry bosses were confident that the immediate panic should subside in a few days, but the complex systemic issues thrown up by Brexit and the pandemic could mean that the UK may be lurching from crisis to crisis for a while to come. For The World, I'm Andrew Connolly in London.
German voters have spoken. The country is taking a small turn to the left. Last night, the Social Democratic Party won the most seats in the Bundestag, Germany's parliament, by the slimmest of margins, and the party's head, Olaf Scholz, could now become Germany's next chancellor. That is, if he can form a ruling coalition. Joining me now is Constanze Stelzenmüller. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. So voters did not give outgoing Chancellor Angela Merkel's Conservative Party a victory. Were these the results that many expected in Germany?
I think all of us were really expecting to be surprised rather than to have something confirmed. For one, we've had a historic number of mail-in votes, something that made the polls more unreliable than normally. We had a very high percentage of people by German standards, over a third, saying that they intended to make up their mind at the last moment. I think all of us sort of sat back and said, well, we'll have to see what happens on the day. But I'm not surprised that the CDU came out relatively badly, because they had been showing distinct signs of electoral and political exhaustion.
Right. Those are the Christian Democrats. That was Angela Merkel's party. So tell us a bit about Olaf Scholz, the man at the head of the victors here, the Social Democrats.
So Olaf Scholz is, of the three candidates running for chancellor in this election, probably the one with the most executive experience. He was mayor of Hamburg and he was finance minister in Angela Merkel's coalition. The other thing is that he had campaigned very shrewdly, I think, on his being a sort of social democratic male version of Angela Merkel. No surprises, nothing to be jittery about, calm, no inclinations to sort of revolutionary policies.
So what has the reaction been in Germany to this victory by Olaf Scholz and the Social Democrats as a party?
There is a sense in Germany that after 16 years of Angela Merkel, who literally at this point is Germany's longest serving post-war chancellor, and with her, the Christian Democrats, a center-right party, it was time for a change. That is, I think, the prevailing mood.
So the Green Party, they came in third, and that is not a win, but in a parliamentary system, third is good news, at least in this case. Explain how the Greens could become a kingmaker here when Scholz tries to form a coalition government.
So well, there are two kingmakers, really, and it's the Greens and the Liberals. So I think more than the Greens, really, the Liberals are the kingmaker. I'll tell you why. The Greens and the Christian Democrats are in psychologically, to some degree, the losers here. Although the Greens have their best result ever, but they had been expected to get about as much or more as the two centrist parties, the Social Democrats and the Christian Democrats, and they didn't. Whereas the Liberals have the strongest showing that they've had in a very long time. And so they and the Social Democrats, I think, see themselves as the winners of this election.
There are a couple of big issues for Germans in this election. Among them was climate change. How did that impact the vote?
Every German was, you know, you'd have to have lived in a cave to have not heard about the disastrous flooding in Rhineland-Palatinate and North Rhine-Westphalia a couple of weeks ago. And German forests also have been, you know, suffering from repeated droughts. I mean, this is not something that ordinary Germans aren't aware of at this point. So the Greens, I think, thought they had Germany's and German voters' attention on this issue. But I suspect that they underestimated the degree to which voters would be willing to follow them on this as the only issue that they were going to vote on.
How will the White House see this vote, do you think?
I think the White House has made it very clear that it sees Germany as a central element of its Europe strategy. And I think the Biden administration's bilateral deal, not sanctioning Nord Stream 2, I think is proof of that.
Constanza, one last thing, a little detail I noticed. Germany votes by paper ballot. I saw a picture of a vast hall post-vote just filled with people. I mean, were those election officials counting paper ballots by hand? Is that how it works?
You know what? I've never seen exactly how they are counted. I suspect that they are machine read and machine counted. They're certainly marked by hand and then, you know, folded and put into an envelope and taken out of that envelope by election officials, which has the great advantage of it being very difficult to hack the system. And as you saw last night, the results are available pretty quickly.
Constanza Stelzenmüller, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She's been speaking with us from Washington. Constanza, thank you very much, as always.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. A decade ago, the new nation of South Sudan was practically born into war. Today, artists are using their talents to help the youngest nation in the world heal.
Music unites people. Artists unite together. And they speak the voice of peace.
Also, a Haitian-American novelist talks about healing her people, coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It's been almost 4 weeks since the last U.S. troops left Afghanistan, but the U.S. and its allies are still keeping a close eye on it. Over the horizon is a term, meaning the eyes are not actually on the ground, but watching from nearby countries. Douglas London is a retired senior CIA operations officer. You were stationed in many places, Douglas, including Central Asia. Many are now saying that that region is key to keeping tabs on Afghanistan. Explain that for us.
Central Asia, as you know, shares a lot of culture and history with Afghanistan and throughout the region. In fact, Afghanistan has minority communities made of Tajiks, Uzbeks, and Turkmen, who likewise have their own countries along the border. They were formerly part of the Soviet Union. They each have their own concerns about stability, and they are concerned with the growth of insurgencies and terrorist groups within their own countries, some of whom have joined and fought with the Taliban over the years, and some of whom have joined and fought with the Islamic State of the Khorasan Province, ISKP. So their view of the issue is very close to home for them.
So the Biden administration has been speaking with authorities in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, those countries in Central Asia that border Afghanistan. What are the basics here? What is the Biden White House looking to get out of these relationships specifically?
Well, with the withdrawal of U.S. troops, also likewise the withdrawal of an official U.S. intelligence presence, the United States is challenged to maintain insight on developments in Afghanistan. The primary reason, as the president keeps reaffirming, that we went to Afghanistan in the first place was to address the threat of terrorism, and specifically Al-Qaeda. Though there was a great deal of degradation of those networks, and they still represent near-term and long-term threats to the United States, including to the homeland. So the United States is looking for ways to augment its ability to maintain both insight on developments in the country, but also an ability to preempt terrorist operations should they develop. I think there will no doubt be some relationship between the United States and those governments, such as the Tajiks and the Uzbeks and the Turkmen. But I think the United States is also looking for places where we could establish technical platforms that could collect against intelligence inside Afghanistan, and to look to work with groups who would be, such as resistance elements, conducting their own intelligence operations to collect information through whom we can engage.
When 9/11 happened, you were in the CIA. Can you give us a picture of the CIA's intelligence collection efforts in Afghanistan in the years before 9/11?
So the advantages that we had in Afghanistan before 9/11 that we didn't have today is that we had relationships with the Northern Alliance, which was various groups. We were having intelligence sharing arrangements, and we were able to actually send teams of CIA officers from time to time inside of Afghanistan, where we could work with their collectors, try to vet the information, provide them some training, and have a better understanding of what we were collecting and how it was being collected. Those were certainly advantages, and that's clearly what enabled CIA to be on the ground in Afghanistan within 15 days of 9/11, where it was a bit more challenging for U.S. military special operations forces. The other side, though, is we take to today, while there's no Northern Alliance operating inside Afghan territory, the United States has had 20 years to develop and cultivate relationships and learn the country. There's an amazing depth of expertise that the United States intel community has about Afghanistan, and there is tremendous relationships that can be leveraged in order to collect intelligence. So there's pluses and minuses to where we find ourselves today compared to where we were in 9/11 on Afghanistan, but certainly we have a much more intimate understanding of the country and know where to look for intelligence and perhaps the people to contact in order to get the information we need.
So that knowledge is really valuable. In retrospect, though, what did the 20 years in Afghanistan do to impact the intelligence collection mission of the agency?
Well, there's various features to that question. There certainly was a shift in culture making the agency a bit more like its military colleagues, whereas the military was trying to become a bit more like the agency in having a flatter, more agile management and more autonomy. The culture of really prioritizing covert action operations, getting ourselves involved with programs such as the Enhanced Interrogation Program and Black Sites, which is a blot, a stain on the CIA. And I think it then set forth a different perspective on the part of leadership. So now, as we find ourselves adjusting today to great power competition from great powers such as Russia or China, or even lesser powers with nuclear capabilities such as North Korea, Pakistan, and Iran's aspirations, I think we find ourselves trying to better align how we approach counterterrorism and how we're going to collect against it. So I think we're going to try to find that balance, and we're going to have to do it after fighting and collecting in a much different way for 20 years, which very heavily lent itself to enabling combat support, either the military's or kinetic operations that the intel community was conducting. So that will be a shift, and I think it will need some time and reform to adjust the culture, which after 20 years has changed.
Douglas London is a retired senior CIA operations officer. He's also the author of a new book that comes out this week titled The Recruiter, Spying, and the Lost Art of American Intelligence. Douglas, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco. It's been a pleasure.
Cambodia is run by a strongman government known for harsh crackdowns against dissent and for general dysfunction. But its COVID vaccine program is remarkable. Cambodia's seat of government, Phnom Penh, appears to be the most vaccinated capital in the world. The world's Southeast Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen explains how the country pulled it off.
Remember February 2020, when the planet was panicking over a mysterious virus in China? Well, Cambodia's Prime Minister, Hun Sen, said, you know, this would be a good time for a trip to China. He was the first head of state willing to visit at the start of the pandemic, and they rolled out the red carpet. Chinese leader Xi Jinping told Hun Sen, you've proven that Cambodia is our all-weather friend. Hun Sen, at 69 years old, actually said he was willing to go to Wuhan. That didn't happen, but he made his point. China, I got your back. And boy, has that paid off. Because when China started giving vaccines to allies, Cambodia was at the front of the line. Today, 98% of adult Cambodians have at least one COVID vaccine in them. 65% of the whole population is fully vaccinated.
For a small, poor country, Cambodia is up there with some of the most successful countries on earth, including the most developed countries in the world as well.
Virak U runs Future Forum, an independent policy research group in Cambodia. And when he says Cambodia is poor, its national economy is smaller than that of the city of Huntsville, Alabama. By most measures, Cambodia's healthcare system is less than stellar, its government is unreliable, and yet when it comes to vaccines, Cambodia is way ahead of U.S. states like Alabama or Ohio or Texas. 65% fully vaccinated, that's more on par with New York. Virak says this has put a strut in Hun Sen's step.
The prime minister is now in that validation mode now, that decisive leadership, a strong man leadership is important during a time of crisis.
I asked Virak U if Cambodia has any issues with anti-vaccine conspiracy theories, which are so rampant in the U.S.
No, there's no such things as what you would see in America. What is happening in America is unique. It's strangely unique.
In fairness, Cambodia's government doesn't tolerate much dissent. But really, Virak U says, the real challenge for any poor country like Cambodia was always going to be getting vaccines in the first place. Hun Sen made sure that would not be a problem. He has fully hitched his star to China. Even before the World Health Organization approved Chinese vaccines, such as Sinovac, Cambodia went ahead and started putting them in people's arms. As Hun Sen told Xi Jinping in person, Cambodia and China, he said, will stand together through weal and woe. Now, China isn't Cambodia's only friend. Cambodia has, in recent history, relied on foreign aid for half of its budget. And the U.S. has been a major donor, too. But it doesn't pay much attention to the country. For example, Washington sent 1 million vaccines to Cambodia, all Johnson & Johnson. China provided 27 million vaccines. And as for the international community, the UN, which has long promised to uplift Cambodia, well, it hasn't sent many vaccines to the country at all. Less than 350,000, courtesy of COVAX, a partner of the World Health Organization, which declined to speak to me for this story. Even Hun Sen himself said a few months back, if I don't ask China for help, who am I supposed to ask? Virak U, the policy analyst, says Western countries have trouble admitting that turning to China paid off for Cambodia.
I think the West doesn't want that to be the case. You know, who want to prove a China model as a successful model in times of rivalry? Can we have an honest discussion in assessing the goods and the bads and the ugly of Cambodia? I think that will be healthy, but I doubt that will take place.
Cambodia's vaccination drive is not over, by the way. Hun Sen wants it to be the most vaccinated country on earth. So, as the U.S. debates vaccinating young children, Cambodia last week started inoculating kids as young as 6. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Nearly two-thirds of Swiss voters backed a referendum supporting same-sex marriage this weekend. With that, Switzerland becomes one of the last Western European nations to legalize the union. In Switzerland, big decisions typically go to a nationwide ballot, like this weekend's referendum, which can slow down major pieces of social legislation. Gay couples there had been allowed to register partnerships since 2007, but marriage now puts them on equal footing. Queer couples will be allowed to adopt children and have easier access to sperm donations. Church groups and conservative political parties vigorously oppose same-sex marriage in Switzerland, arguing it would undermine the traditional family. LGBTQ couples will be able to head to altars across Switzerland next July and say I do in French, German, Italian, or Romanche, the four official languages of the country. At least six flights carrying Haitian deportees touched down in Port-au-Prince today. The passengers had been gathered at the U.S. border in Del Rio, Texas last week. Haiti is struggling to incorporate the new arrivals. For writer Edwige Dantica, the forced return is almost more than Haiti can bear. Dantica is the author of several books, including most recently Everything Inside. Edwige Dantica, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Like many of us, you're no doubt still processing the images from the past week. Haitians being chased by border guards with whips on horseback, crowds packed with virtually no food or water under this international bridge. What do you think will be the lasting impact of those images and events inside Haiti and for the diaspora?
I, like a lot of Haitian and Haitian diaspora folks, are still processing these images, are still feeling very much with the folks who had to go through that in such a painful and humiliating and heartbreaking way. And in conversations that I've had with friends and family in Haiti, they too were shocked. People are starting to arrive in Haiti now and are telling their stories. And many of them speak of that harrowing journey, some of them going to 10 countries and walking on foot across that Darien Gap. And then many of them said they were woken up in the night and taken on a plane and then deported to Haiti. Some of them shackled on the plane, not being able to hug their babies across the aisle, some of them have said.
So at the center of this, obviously, are the Haitians who are being deported, who've crossed the dangerous Darien Gap in Central America. You've written and spoken about how Haitian communities survive in crisis, and there are two concepts I'd like you to just tell us about. One is the Creole term lacou, and my understanding is it's basically about inclusion. Explain lacou and how it comes into play in this moment of crisis.
I come from an agricultural family in rural Haiti. People just organize themselves and gather into groups. And it's usually around a courtyard of an elder or someone who's at the center of the family. But we extend that concept when folks are in need. So we've not seen those images so much in the United States, but after the recent earthquake in the Southern Peninsula, there were people traveling by boat with tons of food that they had grown to bring it to others who were in the stricken areas. And the same happened after the earthquake in Port-au-Prince, where people were coming from the north who had food to try to help others. So because there's been such a lack of support from the state, and people in Haiti still believe in the state, like if they're being interviewed, they'll say, you know, the state hasn't done anything, we haven't been given anything. But at the same time, you know that they can count on their neighbors, and often it is their neighbors who are their first responders, who are helping them in these moments of deep crisis, which is a narrative that we don't always get to see on the outside of Haitians helping Haitians when they're in most dire need.
There's another concept that might help us understand how Haitians are coping, the word combite in Creole. What does that mean, and how are you seeing it being put into practice?
Well, combite comes from an agricultural practice in which if someone has a plot of land that they need working, you know, today you work my plot of land and tomorrow I work your plot of land, which I was thinking about that this whole past week as we're looking at folks coming across the border. So, you know, this is the world. Your program is the world. And, you know, what is happening in the world right now is that we have something like close to 80 million people around the world who have been displaced. And if they were a nation, they would be the fifth largest nation in the world. So I think it behooves all of us to learn globally this notion of combite, because today it's our turn, but tomorrow it could be yours.
Right. I mean, it's important to remember that Haiti was the very first place in the Western Hemisphere to abolish slavery. That was 1804. I know the abolition of slavery there terrified many in the U.S. What do you think has been the long-term results, the consequences of that revolt in Haiti? Does it live on today in some way in U.S.-Haitian relations?
It absolutely does live on today. I mean, the images are literally trying to take us back into the past, into a moment where after Haiti became the world's first Black republic, it was in the U.S.'s backyard. You know, Thomas Jefferson at the time urged Congress to suspend commerce with Haiti, financially choking this new republic, which was already struggling to pay an independence debt to its former colonizer, France. And there was the U.S. occupation after the assassination of a previous president, Vilboin Guillaume Sam. That occupation lasted 19 years, and the U.S. controlled Haiti's finances until 1947. So there's been a very long and sort of mired history of Haiti in the U.S., but often when it's presented, the U.S.'s failures in Haiti are often presented as Haitian failures. We have our own responsibilities, of course, in the matter, but there's a historical layer that Haitians know very well, but that needs to be told and retold, especially as Haitians are asking and demanding an opportunity to make their own decisions and guide their own course and lead their country.
Edwige Jantika, what will it take for the pattern to break?
It will take new visions. It will take the U.S. seeing Haitians as equals and as partners, people they can sit across the table from and make decisions with and not for.
Edwige Jantika is the author of several books, including most recently Everything Inside. Thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Flights are being canceled on Spain's Canary Islands off the coast of West Africa. That's because volcanic ash is clouding the air. Lava flows on the Canary island of La Palma have buried more than 500 buildings and displaced thousands of people since last week. For the latest and the science behind this eruption, I spoke this afternoon with Loic van der Kleizen, a volcanologist at Drexel University in Philadelphia.
The eruption is ongoing. There are fluctuations in the amount of lava that comes out, and that's pretty normal for this type of eruption. In the last couple of days, there's been new breakouts of lava that are invading new valleys and flowing toward new neighborhoods. So more people have been evacuated, more buildings have been destroyed, but overall, the eruption has been progressing in the same manner that the previous ones from these volcanoes also have. Typically, these eruptions, they last between 1 to 2 months.
So I gather this is a volcano, the one on La Palma, that's not on a seismic fault line. Rather, it's one that's at a hot spot, like the volcano that formed the Hawaiian Islands, which I know you've studied extensively. Help us understand the difference between being in a so-called hot spot and being on a seismic fault line.
Yeah, the majority of volcanoes on Earth are close to plate boundaries, places where there are a lot of earthquakes, a lot of volcanoes. But there's a small number of volcanoes around the world that are caused by these, quote, hotspots. There are places in the Earth mantle that are just warmer than others. And the majority of these volcanoes, there may be between 20 and 40 hotspots around the world. The majority produce lava that is very fluid. And as a result, the eruptions from these hotspot volcanoes tend to be fairly fluid lava flows rather than very explosive eruptions. So if people think of volcanoes like Mount St. Helens, that is not the type of eruption that you typically see at a place like Hawaii or the Canary Islands.
What causes these hotspot volcanoes to become active suddenly?
The hotspots themselves, the mantle plumes or these hot upwellings, they're kind of continuously fed. They're constantly producing magma at depth. They need to reach a critical mass of magma that accumulates in the crust. And once you create these pockets of buoyant, hot, liquid rock, then they reach a critical threshold when they can start rising. And that magma has to go all the way to the surface before an eruption happens. And the majority of the time, the magma gets injected in the crust and then freezes in the crust and doesn't actually create an eruption at the surface. So about a week before this eruption happened, we started getting seismic signals indicating there was magma on the move inside the crust, but the uncertainty remained as to whether it was actually going to create an eruption.
It's funny, whenever I talk about volcanoes, I always think of the lava lamp. And as you described it, I was thinking of those bubbles that look like they're about to come out of it, but they never actually fully go out, obviously. That would be a dangerous thing to have around the house.
Well, I have a lava lamp in my office. It's a great teaching tool. I love the lava lamp. And this is a perfect analogy for hotspots. These blobs of hot material that as they get hotter close to the lamp of the lava lamp, they start rising. And then when they got to the top of the lava lamp, they cool and they start sinking. And so that's a perfect analogy for a hotspot.
So this activity, this volcanic activity on the Canary Islands, does it have any knock-on effects? Like, does it relate to all other volcanic activity in some way
That's a good question. Because these hotspots are independent features and they're not related to any fault zones, they're not indicative of any other activity anywhere around the world. So I know that volcanoes have been in the news a lot lately. There's been St. Vincent, there's been the eruption going on in Iceland, but they're unrelated to one another. And the activity that we're seeing today is completely average compared to activity last year or 10 years or 20 years ago.
Loic van der Kleijsen, a volcanologist at Drexel University in Philadelphia. Thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
South Sudan and East Africa became independent 10 years ago. In the following decade, its citizens saw war and political turmoil. For young South Sudanese, stories of displacement and of dreams deferred are common. But as David Lemuria reports from the capital, Juba, artists are working to transform that narrative.
Kenya's Papillon Band takes the stage in front of a couple dozen people at an art gallery. Papillon has been touring South Sudan for weeks, performing at clubs and bars. But this outdoor show at the Baobab House is about more than just the music.
Thank you so much. Are we together?
Band leader Martin Mrini is from Kenya, but he can connect to the experiences of many here in South Sudan. He starts the evening by talking about his mother, whom he lost 10 years ago.
She ran away. Remember, she's mentally ill. We can't find her. This is someone who is first time in the city, and she ran away. We are very sad. We looked for her everywhere, police stations, everywhere, name it.
It's a story shared by many in attendance. Painter Abulo Yai is the founder of the Baobab House. She joins Papillon on the podium.
I was separated from my mom at the age of 4 or 3. I mean, 1991. And with time, I grew up with different women. And what I only met my mom in 2009.
Young people in South Sudan bear marks of traumatic experience throughout the years of war. Many have grown up separated from parents and loved ones. Abul says she was inspired to create this event after talking to many friends who have talked about harming themselves. They are struggling with trauma and financial pressures.
The decades of war and the recent two conflicts, 2013 and 16, you find our parents have not healed from trauma, from what they've been through, and we also, we've experienced it, and it's just trouble passed on over and over.
But Abul says the music and conversations help them process the difficult past. As a global health pandemic continues to disrupt lives, South Sudanese are still fending off COVID-19 while government leaders search for peace. The artists say they want to change South Sudan's narratives. Emmanuel Yak is a popular DJ in Juba. He goes by DJ E. He says the universal language of music is vital in uniting South Sudan's social fabric through live experience.
So in South Sudan, music is a tool for peace. It unites people. Whenever people are having a very big tragedy, people going through things, artists unite together, come and they speak the voice of peace.
Spaces like the Baobab are providing avenue for South Sudanese to connect and forge a future together. For The World, I'm David Lemuria, Juba, South Sudan.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you back here tomorrow.